I'm recording, I'm rolling, I'm ready when you are.
I'm recording as well, and rolling. Like rolling and polling like a roly-poly ham sandwich.
Is a roly-poly ham sandwich got ham and jam in it?
Is that the... Yeah, I know. That's why I made a bad face.
Oh, okay, because it's like ham.
Because I thought about like a Swiss roll, like a Victoria Swiss roll, but with the cream and the jam and the very light, soft sponge cake all rolled up delicately.
Yes.
But then because I said a roly-poly ham sandwich instead of jam,
yes,
I've now added a thick layer of ham into this
honey mustard ham.
Or like a Black Forest ham. I don't know, maybe wafer thin ham. But either way, I do fundamentally feel that the addition of ham into the jam roly-poly cake is an affront to my imagination. And I'm just angry with myself that I said those words because now I'm imagining it and I don't like it. Hello and welcome to the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, the podcast about board games. Board games and the people who love board games. My name is Matt Lees and I am joined by Tom Brewster.
Hi, I'm ready to talk about board games and not the horrible treats that this country probably made at some point in the past.
Yeah, honestly, like Great Britain has a fascinating history of forbidden combinations of meats and sweets. So yeah, you're not wrong. Actually, it's in many ways adding ham into a jam roly poly cake pudding is a very very English thing to do.
Quintessentially, and I think English tradition. I feel like that those are the sort of three main food groups of our forefathers. It was meats, sweets, and the third group, jellies.
Yes. Oh gosh, I'm so glad that we. Let's just. I have a little moment to think about how wonderful multiculturalism is and the fact that now we have a variety of foods in England and not just like, I'll smash some berries up with this pig. Eat it.
Thank God that the world showed us away from the dark path of jellifying literally anything.
Yeah, I don't want to think about that world. Let's talk about some board games.
Yeah, let's do that instead. On this podcast, we're going to talk about three games. We're going to talk about Loners, a card game that's got some funky punks on the cover. Matt's been playing that. I don't know anything about it, as proved by this introduction. We're going to be talking about Gold Country, a game of prospecting gold veins and trying to make you some money. It's just points. And we're going to talk about Eight Dragons, a game with no fewer than eight dragons.
There's loads.
The first game on this podcast that we're going to talk about is Loners, designed by Dan Cassaro, with art by Young Jerk / Brett Stenson, and published by West Coast. What a nice little card game this looks like.
Honestly, I really, really like it. And I want to talk about it on the podcast because I think you'd really like it as well, Tom. And
there's
also
no
because...
lead being buried here.
No. No, I'm not burying anything today. I've done my back in, for starters. But... Yeah, I think this game is really cool. And also, I want to say that I think this game has been a little hard done by in terms of the initial reception, in terms of I think lots of people have looked at it and gone, because it has some elements in similar elements to the game Scout, the card game, which we love and we know. And obviously, very recently, another game came out called Done Up, which is made by the person who made Scout, and it has a lot of Scouty DNA as well. So I feel like there's a lot of Scouty DNA bubbling around in the pool of life right now, and because of that, a lot of people have gone, well, this just why do I need this when it's just like this? I don't think it is. And I think it's the sort of thing where actually, Tom, if you played this and heard people saying, this is just the same as Scout, you'd be annoyed, because you're a card game connoisseur. And I'm a little bit annoyed, but I think you'd be really annoyed. Because, yes,
there are
some surface levels similarities. But actually, it's got a lot of its own stuff going on. And importantly, it's got lots of cool, muscly dudes in the cards.
Oh, yeah. For whatever reason, I thought this game was punk-like. But now I'm looking at the sort of cover. It kind of looks like Bodybuilder Dad.
It's got an extreme... like divorced dad's energy. You know, it's all like these hard dudes who won't agree with one another and maybe get into fights. And, you know, obviously all of West Coast manuals have a kind of like a flavor to them that's fun. And some of the little like bits of flavor text in here just really bring it to life in a way that's just like, this is silly. This is a kind of silly, neon, jokeified view of... masculinity. Kind of reminds me of the film like I Think They Live. No, what's it called? The film with the
They Live with the two guys having the big fight in the alley? Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, where the aliens take over and...
Yeah. The aliens, and they've been there all along. And they've been there all along. Roddy Piper in it.
Yeah, and, you know, the entire character was basically Duke Nukem. Duke Nukem just stole all of the catchphrases and stuff. That kind of, like, over-the-top, like, guys in gangs brawling. It has that kind of silly, macho vibe. The game itself, very similar to Scout initially in the fact that you get a hand of cards and you're not allowed to move them. Difference is there's no upside down cards here. There's no like options. It's just here's your hand of cards. They're in this order. You have to play them out from where they are. And on your turn, you're going to be playing a card to the middle. You're playing a gang of people. And then you got to try and, as a next player, beat that gang to stay in the fight. The way you do that is you play a better hand. That's simple in terms of if I play a 5, then you could play like a 5-6. Or you could play like, you know, a run or a set. Sets are better than runs. And all you have to do is just play a better one than the person who came before you. And you keep doing that until somebody can't beat it. If you can't beat what's in the middle of the table, then there's a couple of things you can do. The first thing you can do is you just pass, right? Which just means that like, hey, that all of the gangs get cleared. It's the end of that fight. And then the next player carries on. They play a new card and they get to start afresh. But you have these loner cards. And the loners are just normal cards that get dealt out into the middle of the table in a circle around the ring where you're playing these fights. And what you can choose to do on your turn is you can choose to buff up a hand by adding one of those cards. So let's just say I've got like a 5, 6, 7 in hand in order. Then there's a 4 as one of the loners. I can take one of the loners, put it on there, and now I've got a run of 4. The problem with involving a loner into your gang is that now your gang is a little less like solid, and it means that someone else can come and steal it. So it means
your
that
your boys aren't as tight.
No, your boys are not as tight, and therefore another boy can come in and fracture that set of boys like a meaty rock down straight down the middle. It means that let's just say I've got 3 4s in my hand and I buff it up with a 4th 4. Oh, that's 4 boys. The problem
that's
is
so many
if
boys.
another player has a 4 in their hand, the next player, they can just play that 4 and then they have played 5 4s. That can only be done once, so you can't just keep escalating. But it means that like you have these cards that you know you can add to make your hand better when you play, but doing so is very dangerous because it means the next player might just be able to steal that power. And especially if you're playing a 2-player game, it becomes very tactical very quickly. Because the key thing about these loners is that you can't win the game until they're all gone. So the other way that a loner can get removed from this circle is if you can't play. If you have to pass, then you clear the deck and you take one of them and you get to put it into your hand and you can put it anywhere you want. So early in the game, tactically doing this is quite nice. It means you can be like, you know what? I'm going to take that 7 and I'm going to start building up a nice set of 7s that I can use to hopefully try and win the game. Because you win the game when you have no cards in hand and there are no loners left in the circle looking to get involved in a brawl.
And see.
If you run out of cards before the loners are all gone, then you have to take all of the loners into your hand. So it becomes
the whole game of misfits. Yeah.
This is the thing that I think makes the game quite different in the fact that it's not just that puzzle that you have in a game like Scout of trying to like align things so you can play a perfect hand. I do this, then I do this, and then I play all of these things and I'm done. Yes, you want to try and do that, and you want to try and key yourself up for getting rid of all your cards in a very neat, efficient way. But if you do it too early and too quickly, then you just end up picking up a collection of crap. And at that point, you just have to put into your hand in the order you pick it up. Like, so you can't rearrange it to make it good.
Yeah.
So it becomes this interesting dance of like trying to like force the other player to like run out of cards more quickly than they want to, or setting it up so that you know that, yes, you're going to have to pick up those things, but you've tried to remove the ones that are a problem. So when you do add them to your hand, you are just creating a perfect hand to like then play. It's got a lot of nuance in it and a lot of like, you don't have to play it many times to be like, oh, and to get like the metagame of this and the way you can really screw people over. And the final thing that's kind of different is there's a way you can break up fights. It's the cops. There's the cops. So there are cop cards. And if you play a cop, then the cop turns up and everyone has to simmer down and the fights have to like chill out a bit, which means that the reverse is true for like power of cards. So if you were like trying to play better, now you have to play worse. So it means like, you know, you could really just start to knock it down and screw people over by just playing a single one, which is the best worst hand you can play, and then everyone else can't play. Ha ha ha. But of course you can cop a cop. If a cop turns up, everyone has to simmer. But then if another cop gets played, then the other cop goes off with that cop and they're both gone and now we're back to normal again. Fights
they're cop
on.
Pals. That's how it works.
So it's a very like it's quite a simple game in some ways, but the rub of the interactions of how these things can occur and knowing that the cards you're playing with are pretty limited. I think there's like, you know, with a two player game, you take out the eight, so you're only playing with cards 1 to 7. So it's not like even a full deck of cards. It means you do get a sense of like what's out there, what people are probably trying to do, and also having this like shared cards in the middle of the table at the start and knowing what people have chosen to take from like, not just like, oh, I'm going to pick up that, but like I'm choosing to take that card from this large selection means it's very easy to kind of like to see what people are doing and to like go, okay, all right, I think I get a sense of what they're doing and then try and work out ways that you can interfere with that. It's a game where very frequently somebody does something and you're like, oh, you absolute flipping. It's, you know, it's a real like grinner. It's a real like, yeah, I just completely ruined your play and we both know it. It's really fun. It's like a tiny little box. It's a lot of fun. It has a different energy to it. It's definitely adjacent to those to games like Scout, but it's like it has its own stuff going on, and I think it holds its own. Like I think it's a really cool little game.
I'm enjoying the dudes a lot. I'm looking through the dudes they got on display for this game, and oh boy, they cooked with that one. It's a lovely little box as well. Like yeah,
it's a
really
tiny,
charming,
lovely
small,
box.
Poppy, colorful
the back
thing.
Of the cards just has like a neon little like cartoon knuckle duster on the cards, and like there's all sorts of nice little details here. I think West Coast are like really excellent at like filling their games with little Easter eggs and tiny little jokes and stuff, like, you know, Fruit Boss, which I really enjoyed Fruit Boss, to be honest. I realized I've been playing it slightly wrong and realized this actually was better than I thought it was originally after playing it a whole bunch. But I love the presentation of that.
That's a nice
really
surprise.
Love,
that's a nice surprise.
Right? And I love what they've done with the manual for Fruit Boss. Like, there was a lot of, like, really funny, weird stuff going on. And that's kind of continued in here in the fact that it is, like, a play on that kind of, like, macho's 80s world and is still, like, actually not celebrating it and is more like loving and laughing at it in a fun way. It's a very cool thing.
Yeah, it's great.
It's definitely
sweet.
Worth a look.
Next up on this podcast, I'm going to tell you about a little game called Gold Country. This is designed by Rainer Knizia with art by Beth Sobel and published by Bite Wing Games. Matt, ring the alarm. Sound the horn. Ding dong the dingus. It's a good Rainer Knizia game.
Ding 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 ding.
Ba, 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 ba.
The dingus this has just shot up and hit the bell at the top.
This is you know, we love our Rainer Knizias, but there is a sort of wide breadth to the quality of his games over the years. Gold Country, I think, is a real slapper. I enjoyed this game a lot. It's not in that kind of like middle of the pack Rainer that we've maybe got a few of recently. And this one's a top tier. In the spirit of this podcast, I'm not burying any leads.
No,
but there is gold buried in them.
These games,
hill games. Because gills. This is a prospecting game. There's gold in these gills. This is a prospecting game where you are trying to get the most gold / points by the end of the game. And the way that you're going to do this is on your turn, you're going to be placing out these little camp pieces onto a sort of hex grid style board. There are four different mining companies, and they all sort of start in the corners of the board. And then you place these camps adjacent to them to form a sort of snaking routes that look a little bit like the sort of camel trails you might see in something like Through the Desert. That's how the placement works. And it's kind of similar to Through the Desert in the fact that you are going to be placing three of these camps in a turn. Although I think you only place two camels in Through the Desert. Real rhino heads. Send me an email.
Send me an angry email.
Send me an angry email.
Got it wrong. Camels have two humps, but there were three camels. It's a common mistake.
There were different colours of riders. I don't remember it very well.
No.
you're going to place these camps out onto the board, forming these routes from these original sort of mining companies. And as these routes go across the board, they're going to touch these discs that kind of cover the board at the start of the game. And mm-hmm. those discs have plus one, or plus two, or plus three, or plus five on them. And if you place a little camp on top of a disc, the value of the company that placed that camp goes up by the amount shown on the disc. Ooh. So the red company, I'm building out a little red route, and then I hit that plus five, and the red company stock goes up, because surprise, Matt, surprise audiences, this is a stocks and shares game.
Right.
It's a little bit of a stocks and shares Trojan horse. You kind of look at this on the table right. and you think, wow, this looks like a nice little route
cool.
building journey.
We're going to be collecting gold. No, you're not.
No, no, not allowed.
Well, you're the clue is in the word, right? Prospecting. It's like, yeah. it's there's no certainties there.
There's a nice sort of conjoining of theme and mechanic, a sort of duality to the word prospecting here, as you are assessing the prospects of the companies who themselves are prospecting for gold.
Yeah, yeah. That's the sort of fancy chat that would have got you shot dead in a bar in the old towns of Deadwood, son.
This is true. So yeah, each of these companies has, alongside placing out these camps on your turn, you can also buy and sell twice stocks and shares from the companies around the table. So you could buy into a company when it doesn't have much going for it, and then you build out its route so that it hits one of those discs, and now suddenly your stock is worth more, and then next turn you could sell it for a profit. But those discs aren't just positive. There's also negative discs out on the board as well, which wrinkles it, because you can have situations where someone drags their sort of like company through a bunch of these negative spaces to tank its value, making everyone else around the table very annoyed. That person then buys in. The other people maybe sell out just because they're annoyed at you. There's lots of interesting sort of player dynamics that happen around these stocks and shares bumping up and bumping down. And it's even more interesting by virtue of the fact that you get dealt these camps randomly from a bag. You don't know what color of camps you're going to get to place until it's the sort of start of your, well, I guess the end of your turn is when you see your next sort of set of camps, and you can have to build a strategy on the fly around that. You might want to make it so that your blue company that you invested into like a huge amount, you want to make sure that you place blue camps so you can get lots and lots of money, but someone else might draw the blue camps before you and steer that route directly into a bunch of negative points. Which I think is delightful and really, really mean. And even meaner still, some of these tiles on the board are gold veins and some of them are mine collapses. If you touch one of the gold veins, every player who owns a share in that company gets paid 2 points per share. So if you have a bunch of shares, you hit a gold vein, you get loads of money. Great. But the collapses cost everybody 2 points per share they have in that company. And so you can do some really mean things where you get everyone geared up to invest into a company that you're getting, making more and more progressively valuable over the course of the game. And then on your turn, you sell a bunch of the shares and you steer them directly into a mine collapse and you laugh as they hemorrhage points and you've just shot into the stratosphere.
That's beautiful.
As you can probably tell, I really enjoyed this game.
Yeah.
I think it really makes the sort of genre of stocks and shares game, which I do enjoy. I have played an 18XX big train game before. I've played a cube rail game before. I like making a company become valuable and then making it become not valuable anymore. It's really fun. But this makes that a much less daunting prospect. It's so much more, prospect. But it's so much more immediate.
Well, it is. It is. You know, if you take away all of the reality of that era, it's very haha. You know, it's like, you know, this person's invested tons of money into trying to make this area big, and then the company's booming because everyone's like, they've got all this land. But then there's just no flipping gold there. It doesn't matter.
Yes.
Like, there's, you know, it's what you're trying to do here is a fool's errand. So, yeah, no, I think that there's something to be said for that, because I do think there is a degree of, like, you know, I think 18XX stuff and those big heavy games that do a lot of this stocks and share stuff, they're great. But, like, there's a lot of room for other games like that. And I think there is a tendency sometimes for that genre in particular to be a little bit, like, not gatekeeper-y, but a little bit like, oh, yeah, but you should be playing, like, this is the best thing you could do. Like, when actually it's like, no, there's a whole bunch of different tiers of experience here. Like,
it's tricky to break into just because the games themselves are often a little daunting to look at. They're daunting to learn. There's a lot going on in them. And the theme might not necessarily click for everyone. Like, it certainly doesn't really click for me. I don't really care about the trains. I'm in it for the money.
Yes.
But the
God, you work for one of the privatized companies in the UK who does trains. That's some
that's
satire.
That's
some
me.
Satire for the Brits there.
Just a little bit of topical.
Just
humor.
A little bit of satire. It's only been topical for like 25 years. All right.
But I do think that those games suffer from a little bit of accessibility concerns, and they are just these sort of like very dense spreadsheety things. And also I think just getting into them is tricky, but also once you've started to even play those games, I find that it does take a while to get into the really like sharp bits of play that makes people love them. There's a lot of stuff that gets in the way that the more you play, the more you realize that stuff that initially you felt was getting in the way is actually there for a really good reason. Mm-hmm. But at the start, at least, you're getting frustrated by having to deal with the craft. You want to get into the sort of nasty player interaction they're famous for. And I think this one just gets you straight into that immediately. I also think that it does a lot of nice things to smooth out the edges of itself, because this is actually one of those re-implementations of an older game that Bitewing have been doing recently, where they go and find a lost Reiner Knizia design that was gathering dust in the cupboard, and they give it a lick of new paint, and they serve it to you on a nice shiny platter. And one of the things I think that they've done is they've added these cards that go at the top of the board that give you a little bit of flexibility in how you're pursuing a single turn. For example, mm-hmm. they let you like choose to place one camp of one color of your choice, which is amazing, but it costs you some points to do so, so you need to really know you want to do it, and it can only be done once in the entire game by every player. So it's a nice bit of flexibility that can sort of like round out a turn to make you let you do something really impressive, but it's nicely limited to make sure you can't just pull that lever every single turn. I really like this game. I think it's a good one. Although, as a final note, I will say that this was almost I was on a real precipice with it. I could have been delivering a very different and a very wrong verdict on this game, Matt, because when I set up this game, I put all the little tiles that show the values face down on the table, and then I was teaching it to the players, and I was like, oh yeah, I actually don't know how you managed to make the companies go, how you make a good decision in this game, because you're just picking up a random tile. And they were like, that seems wrong. And I was like, yeah, it does seem wrong.
Well, you know, you say that, but when you started explaining the game, I assumed that was going to be the case as well, just because that's one of the instances where, you know, we talk about like mechanics and theme merging, but I think that's actually one of these things where it's the opposite in a way. There's a, there's a gratingness there where being like, oh, it, so of course you don't know if there's gold there or not, but no, it's a different system. The value of the land is present. It's just the gold veins are not.
You could make it sort of even more thematic to prospecting to make it a complete blind chance as to whether your company value is up and down. And maybe then it will represent the real stock market better as well.
Yep. And also maybe if you have got good land, you just mysteriously fall off a cliff and somebody else gets
maybe.
It.
Yeah.
Classic.
All copies of Gold Country should come with a small cliff to push your fellow players off of anything.
It should come with a treacherous chap with a transatlantic accent comes in every box who's like, I don't know, sir, how about I buy that land off you for one shiny dollar? And you're like, I'm good. And it's like, well, we're going to kill this boy and take all of his gold. What did you say, Hector? I didn't say nothing at all. Don't you worry, pal. Hoot-de-doo.
That's Gold Country by Reiner Knizia.
How on earth do Bitewing Games afford all of those oldie-timey style prospector men that they put in every single one of their games? A full man. It's incredible. What a service. Finally on the podcast, we're going to be talking about a game called Eight Dragons. This is a game by Sunke Schmidt with art by Paulina Hananomi, and it's published by Wonderbow Games, the same people who put out Kelp, a delightful two-player head-to-head game about a squid trying to hide from a shark by being all tricksy-like.
Two-fin, eight-leg deathmatch. That's
exactly.
Its real title.
Two-fin, eight-leg. Octopus do have eight leg. That's true. But I realized the other day that we keep saying that spiders have eight legs and that scorpions have eight legs. But really, scorpions have six legs and two arms. And really, spiders have six legs and two arms. And if we're going to go around saying that spiders have eight legs, we need to start saying that humans have four legs. Do you know what I mean?
Dog
sign my petition.
Has four hands.
Right, well, that's not true. Dog has four legs. Horse has four legs. But human have two legs. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. And now I'm going to talk about Eight Dragons. So this is a delightful little production where you have a board of a fantasy kingdom with a figure eight kind of like etched into the cardboard in a double layer thing. So you have this figure eight like train track, if you will. But it's not a train track. It's a dragon track.
Oh, and my God.
These dragons, you have your main dragon and then you have little dragonlings. And the main dragons are the ones that you move on your turn. So you're going to move your dragon. However, these little dragonlings are going to connect to the back in the way that those wooden toys, you know, those wooden train toys you get that like kids bloody
love.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where like they lock in. They lock into like a little slot in the back and then you can pull them behind. It does that with dragons, which means you pull your dragon along and it pulls all these other little dragonlings along around it. And then honestly, like at that point, I was like, this is really cool.
I love that. I can make a little dragon train.
You know, I've got to say, like, a lot of people will just see this and be like, I want to play that. And it's a pretty lightweight, simple-ish game. And if you've got people who want to play it, then I'd recommend it on that alone. However, I was hoping for a little more with it because there's some rub here. And I've only played the basic version of the game. And I think if you mixed it up and played with some of the kind of more randomized setup that the game recommends for future games, then it might have a little bit more wrinkle to it, might have a little bit more rub, but there's some really cool ideas here. So one of the main things is that every time you get back to the center of this figure eight, it's described as being like the Windy Mountains Valley, which means you can't stop there. You must continue and
you
keep
get
flying
through.
You get guffed all the way through, including all the dragons following you. But then you get to choose which way you want to go. And there are two halves to the kingdom. And when you fly around these spots, each of the little like nodes around the edge of these circles represents a different action that happens, a different location. And you're going to activate all of them, not just the one that your main dragon stops at, but each of the dragonlings behind it in the chain are also going to activate their corresponding action in these locations. And they're going to be activated by the player that owns those dragonlings.
I see.
So it immediately gets a little bit spicy because you think, well, I want to do this action. But if I do that, it means behind me is another player's dragonling. And you don't get to choose which ones are attached to you. It's just you just collect another one when you move past the mountain and there's a chain of them. And it means that you have a weird thing where you go, well, if I go here, then that's going to give the other player 4 gold because they're next up here. And then, but afterwards, I get this one with my dragonling and then they get to do this. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of like tactical positioning of going, well, what's the best thing for me to do? Because you're quite free about how you move, right? There's a kind of equator marked on the board between like the two halves, and you've got like the kind of sunny side of the board on the bottom, and then at the top it's all frosty. And it just has a rule you're not allowed to pass over that like frost barrier more than once on your turn. So you can move like pretty much as far as you want in one circle in one go. Mm-hmm. So you can really just calibrate it to be like, this is what I want to happen on my turn. You move it, you activate those things. And the fun thing is that you go from the front to the back. Just like Craig David did back in the day. And it means that you activate yours and then you go backwards through the chain of dragons. What's fun about this is one of the types of things that can happen on these spaces is sending a dragon back to the roost, back to the collection point.
Dispelling someone else's dragon.
Well, you can do it to your own if you want. And at the start of the game, dispel you do that because you want to put more of your dragons into the mix because they don't all start off in the kingdom. But as you go, you're like, you know what? I'm going to dispel someone else's dragon. And it means before they even have the chance to get that action in the chain, they get woofed over out of the chain and then it all sucks together. So it means all the dragons behind slip up and connect to the one behind. And it means that you can basically stop other people from getting actions that they would have got, which feels really nice. There's also some interesting interactions between the two halves of the board where like you have a thing where like every time you activate this little treasure temple on one side of the figure eight, you get all of the money that's on it and then it adds 3 money to the one on the other side. So you have a weird thing where like an economy where like, hey, if you go and buy a tile at this shop, then it refreshes the shop on the other side. So it means you can keep staying on one side of the board and keep looping around there. But by doing that, more often than not, you're adding resources and refreshing the resources on the other side. It's a simple thing.
I see.
But it's a nice little idea.
I'm seeing a lot of hexagons Yes. Which I don't necessarily, it doesn't really click with what you're describing, right? Because I see this main board that almost is like a slightly elaborate, not really worker placement, almost worker movement, worker dragging, dragon yes. dragons.
Dragon and dragons.
Is kind of what's going on the main board.
I'm and getting how the hexes to the, fit. I accidentally buried the hexagon lead.
You're building to the hexagons.
we're getting to the hexagons now. Don't worry. This is a classic board game description. I'm saying, don't worry, but
I'll
get to the hexagons. I'm getting to the hexagons in a minute. Kevin, just sit down. I'll get to the hexagons. The hexagons are how you win the game, how you score the game. In front of you, you are building out like a little treasure cavern for your dragon. Because you're a dragon, you want a cave with the most treasure.
It's that simple.
So you're collecting all the gold. Yeah, you literally are. Like, gold is something that you can spend. It's something you can gain. But gold is the resource you want at the end of the game. And you're going to get gold on your little, like, cave that you're building. You build out a cave by collecting these tiles. And you have different types of tiles representing the different kinds of, like, species of dwellers living in this land. So you've got dwarves and elves and humans and all the stuff you'd expect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are, if you see a picture of the board, there's like a kind of grid in the middle of the circles of these little like yes. character meeples. Fantasy people that get placed into those villages. And yes. the number of fantasy people in each of those villages, up to a maximum of 4, because they're all the same type. So if you have 4 elves in a village, that means you get better access to tiles from when you land on that space. So when you stop mm-hmm. off at that elf village, you get to take a tile from the elf stack, and like if there's one elf there, you can take a basic one, but if there's 2 elves, you can take one of the really good ones or 2 I basic see. ones, and yeah. vice versa. And you just top deck from these piles of tiles, which then get added to your little tableau of
dragon cave.
And then, you know, there's stuff within the dragon cave, like there's symbols on these things. So it's like, hey, you want to collect sets of maybe one type of resource. You've got a secret objective. You've got public objectives you're trying to do. You've got the ability to get more bonuses by, like, if you have like open chambers and you have these circles, and if you can align 3 circles on the 3 pieces that when you stick them together and all of the chambers are either the same type or all different types, then you're going to get an immediate gold bonus. So there's lots of like late game scoring stuff, but also some immediate poppy stuff of going, I do this so I get some yeah. more things. The game's very pacey because like you're kind of always playing. Like, even if someone else is activating their dragon, chances are they've got at least one of your dragonlings behind them. And it means you're going to get to do something on their turn. The flip side of that, though, is it's incredibly satisfying when you can work out a way to do things that constantly leaves the other player in a situation where, on your turn, they get nothing. It's beautiful. It's just like, oh, and I get this, and I get this, and I get this. Oh, and your dragon's on this spot. Oh, but you can't do anything there. It doesn't get you anything right now, does it? I'm sorry about that. And the whole, like, it's not so much like, wouldn't say it's like a living world, but it's a fascinating little clockwork creation in a way.
Yeah,
like you've got these things where like activate this side, it balances the other side. And then there's also a nice little thing. There's these little ogre meeples you'll see. And the way they work is you've got these spots on either circle on the top and the bottom. And every time you land a dragon on one of those and activate it, the ogre will move one space towards that side. And then each time that happens, before that happens, there's like coins printed and you get as many coins as are between you and the ogre, which means if you can get right. the ogre to walk all the way to the other side and then activate the bottom of it, you get loads of money.
That's profit. That's pure profit.
And it's a nice bit of theme that you can see the little ogre meeple has this big sack of gold over their shoulders and there's a hole in the bottom and it's like dropping gold and it's clearly just like walking back and forth chasing you, and while it's doing that,
that's
it's just like
super cute.
Dropping money. It's really cute. Like, there's a lot of stuff here that I really liked. And like they're building out your little cave. It's fun. I think the fact that you can have this element of, you know, because also these dragons that swoop around this figure 8, they can push each other like trains.
Mm. Yeah. That's what I was wondering, if you could create a little dragon blockage, but you can't.
You can't block things, but you can push things. So you can be like, you know what? I'm going to shunt this dragon. And, you know, there's rules where, like, I think you can't shunt everything through the same way, so you have to, like, divert them. Again, it's very trained. It's very, don't tell anyone, but it's very trained.
Don't tell anyone. This is a secret trains special.
But because there's a rule where, like, any dragon that gets moved gets activated, you can have some really cool big turns where you end up, like, pushing another dragon train that flies through the wind tunnel, then you fly through the wind tunnel, and then loads of stuff gets activated all at once. But because it's always a very knowable order, and you always know it's going to like do the dragon on your side of the hemisphere, then the other dragon, and do those things in order, you can have some really big brain moments of going, okay, then I'm going to do this, 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 which activates that, which is going to make this good. I personally would have liked more of that, especially when you've got the ability to like remove dragons from a chain to stop someone from doing something just before they do it, and having the ability to shove other things around. However, that I think is just me being silly galaxy brain Matt and wanting everything to be an incredibly crunchy, complicated game. And I think as it is, it's probably like a good, like higher end family weight game. Like, you know, sure. there's some trickiness here, but moving the dragons around, swooping around, collecting them, it was all very delightful.
Quite playful and quite satisfying, right?
It was. It was playful. It was satisfying. It had that kind of like cause and effect poppiness of things happening that just, it was cool. It had some cool mechanics in it that made me think this would be pretty delightful for a lot of people. I liked it. It was cool.
Nice. It seems really sweet. Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We talked about three games, we talked about loners, we talked about Gold Country, and we talked about Eight Dragons. If you want more from Shut Up and Sit Down, then on the YouTube channel just this week was our latest entry into the Shut Up and Sit Down Top 100 series. We talked about Twilight Imperium.
Yes.
The big, chunky space game that people kind of like.
Yeah. People kind of like it. People love it. We love it.
People love it.
Yeah, if you're a podcast fan, I'd highly recommend having that video. Even if you just put it on the background. It's a big video. It's a long chat. We chat about TI in all sorts of ways. We chat about the expansions. We chat about what it means to us, what it meant to us, how that's changed over the years. And then we also, it's a brief teaser of us rating how sexy all of the characters are.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, like, you know, that's... It happened.
I smooch a turtle.
Yeah, just to try it.
In HD,
the taste of
in
his
4K.
Yeah, and if you want to watch the whole long version of that breakdown, which is quite an extensive sort of dating adventure, then you can do so by supporting us, and that'll be in the next newsletter. Will be the video of us the full. I'm not going to say unedited because, gosh, there's probably stuff we had to edit out for legal
Almost
reasons.
Almost certainly. It was very expensive.
But definitely an extensive version of us breaking down the correct tier list of sexiest to least sexy characters in the TR universe.
It's true. It's factual. It is an undisputable bit of tier listing.
Journalisting.
It's journalisting. It's straight up journalisting.
Yes, but with the list in caps.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you very soon. Goodbye.
See you soon.
Bye.